She says the 20th century means I'm already out of date. Thanks a lot. So, rational animal is perhaps the longest standing definition of human being that we have. It is a definition not without problems, for we have learned in the process of discovering that our world, as including the animals, is an evolutionary product, that reasoning is not a process restricted to humans, although some types of reasoning do seem to be species-specifically human, mathematics certainly one of the principal among them. I am not, professionally speaking, a mathematician, though I was pretty good in mathematics through high school, up to and including the calculus and the use of the slide rule, which I am told is considered antiquated for students of mathematics today. So I felt it was both a privilege and an embarrassment for me to be speaking here at the Fields Institute. Indeed, had the invitation with accompanying friendly pressure not come from Professor Danese coded in Fibonacci numbers, I would have declined. However, here I am, and I will do my best to address what seems to me, if not the heart of mathematics, certainly something very central thereto, namely the concept of relation as a mode of being at work singularly in human reasoning. Where is the triangle demonstrated by Euclid to have angles equaling or totaling 180 degrees? It is equally accessible to all of us, and yet it is nowhere in the usual sense of where, namely a location within our physical surroundings that can be identified in terms, say, of longitude and latitude, and I know there's new systems for that, a location we can describe, circumscribe, and travel to, a location where once we have completed our travel, we can look and point and say, aha, there is our triangle. Well, hardly. And yet, Euclid's triangle is not really Euclid's possession, nor could it be if he wanted to own it, for it is nowhere in space and time as measured by longitude and latitude or any version thereof. And yet the triangle in question, the one whose angles can only equal 180 degrees, is a public figure, one that all of us in this room, indeed all of us on this planet or any planet, at this time or at any time, past or future, can relate to. Pretty strange, come to think of it. No wonder Plato, who believed that our souls are intelligences only temporarily occupying bodies, is said to have inscribed on the portal to his academy, "Let no one who knows not geometry enter here." For he would rely on geometry to teach his disciples that reality is not something that can be seen or touched, nor in any way grasped properly by the senses, but is something that can only be understood, and once understood, seen to belong to a realm in which sensation and material objects have no part. Aristotle may have succeeded overall in reducing Plato's ideas to footnotes on his own rather different first philosophy or metaphysics as it came to be known, but he did not succeed, so far as his surviving writings tell us, fully to explain how the objects of geometry, or for that matter, any other objects, achieve by their nature the status of public in principle. For that is what every object is, at least within the context of linguistic communication, something public in principle, in contrast with, say, a toothache, which fortunately for all save the one who has it, is a private matter of awareness. The idea that I want to present for your consideration is that the concept of relation, if developed properly, I say if, for one of the less well-realized meanings of rational animal is slow learner, gives us the only hope there is of understanding how and why objects, as objects of awareness, are always and necessarily public in principle, precisely because relation is the only mode of being that transcends subjectivity, and by that very fact enables semiosis. Aristotle learned from Plato that there is something irreducibly peculiar about relation. Substances are the true natural units of the physical world, or genuine individuals. And like all individuals, real or apparent, substances have accidents, that is to say, identifying and distinguishing characteristics, among which are relations, as, for example, the relation which distinguishes you as a child of that parent and not a child of this parent, and so on. But as a characteristic of individuals, relations are already peculiar, because whereas all other characteristics of individuals are subjective features that exclude one another, relations somehow elude the principle of contradiction in that one and the same thing at one and the same time can enter into contrary relations. For while you cannot be overweight and underweight at one and the same time, yet at one and the same time you can be fat relative to Mary and skinny relative to Sue. Plato never resolved the difficulty, for he never thematized the problem thus posed. Plato, it may be said, left the way open for the resolution proposed by William of Ockham. Relations have no reality of their own, but amount to no more than comparisons made within and by some mind of subjects existing outside of the mind making the comparison. No, Aristotle would insist, followed later by Aquinas, both thinkers in advance of, but neither understood on the point by, William of Ockham. Relations have a being of their own that is, or as we shall see, can be, independent of finite mind. But as a characteristic of some individual, relation is not on the same footing, as it were, does not have the same standing as do other characteristics. For my personal being exists in me, as does my size, shape, weight, and so on. But my relative being exists most obviously between me and something else, something or things within my surroundings. It was this contrast between existing or being in and existing or being between that Aristotle latched onto in defining relation as that whose whole being consists in being toward another. He did not come by the formula easily. In fact, it took him 3 tries, the first 2 of which failed to distinguish relation as a mode of being, either from the other varieties of individual characteristics or indeed from substance itself, the actual individual characterized. Unfortunately for the history of philosophy, Aristotle was so relieved to have finally hit upon a definition of relation as a category or mode of mind-independent being, that he then simply reverted to his original contrast between substance as a being in itself, or an individual in the natural world, and accident as a characteristic of such an individual. Now, I say unfortunately, because the history of philosophy has taught us only all too well that anyone who approaches Aristotle's thought in terms of his distinction between substance as being in itself an accident as being in another has less than a 10% chance of understanding a relation as an irreducibly distinct mode of being among the inherent accidents. For only inherent accidents fit the formula of beings in another, that is to say, characteristics of an individual which qualify or modify that individual in its here and now actual existence. Relations may or may not so qualify the individual in question. When they do, they are necessarily based or founded upon actual characteristics of the individual in question. But when they do not, there are 2 possibilities. Either they once did, because they were in fact founded upon characteristics of the individual, the case of truth past, or they never did, but are attributed thereto upon some other founding basis, the case of fiction, in quotation marks, whether through mistake, intention, a writer of fiction, or deceit, a liar. The first case, when they do, that's the only case that Aristotle pursued to the end. He was interested in to'on, being, as it exists, independently of human thought, belief, opinion, or desire, and in relation as a mode of that being, ens reale, the Latins would say, being as finite mind independent. Relieved as he was after 2 unsuccessful tries in arriving at a formula that would define relation without undermining his understanding of substance as being in itself, the individual unit of nature, and its contrast with accidents as characteristics of individuals, he just went on to other things. And to this day, interpreters of Aristotle begin their discussion of to'on with the substance-accident distinction, proceeding from there with very few exceptions to arrive at the conclusion of Occam. Relation has no being of its own in the order of what obtains independently of finite mind other than in its fundament. See? It's a subjective characteristic of the individual which leads an observer to compare that individual with others, giving rise in the comparing to a relation over and above the individuals compared, which relation itself in its being toward has no existence at all apart from the finite mind in which the comparison has been made. I was even stunned to see Lakoff reducing metaphors to states of the neural system. On this common interpretation, then, there are actually not two cases, one where the relation as such is mind-independent, and a second, subdividable, where the relation is mind-dependent. There is, in reality, quote, only the one case where the relation is a creation of finite mind comparing two or more things. There remains the other interpretation, the only one that actually gets the text of Aristotle right in its treatment of relation. This is the view that relation has a positive being toward that is over and above the subjectivity of the individual, esse and se, and over and above the characteristic of that individual, esse and alio, upon which the relation depends for its own existence as intersubjective. And this term here, intersubjective, marks a key point. For in order to be in the order of ens reale, a mind-independent being, relation required reality in the sense of an existing subject, a substance, both on the side of its foundation and on the side of its terminus. But this very fact, Aquinas observes, should serve to notify us that inner subjectivity, while characteristic of relation in the order of ens reale, is not the characteristic that is essential for a relation to be a relation. For being toward is the one and only type of being, the one and only, that from its positive nature as a type does not require that it posit something realizable only mind-independently, whence occur instances of being toward which, as relations, are nothing in the mind-independent realm, yet do obtain objectively and publicly within awareness. Something that is impossible for any mode of being in or subjectivity, whether being in itself, substance, the individual, or being in another, accidents, the inherent characteristic. So Sherlock Holmes is not a substance, see? If we now ask, in the light of this consideration, what is the positive and defining character of relation, we find that it is not intersubjectivity directly, but simply suprasubjectivity. The fact that relation always transcends the order of subjectivity to which substance and inherent accidents necessarily belong, and as a consequence of this transcendence, relation is also indifferent to being realized intersubjectively. Any given relation will, as a relation, always exist supersubjectively, but only sometimes will it exist intersubjectively. To exist intersubjectively is necessarily to exist supersubjectively, but to exist supersubjectively is not necessarily to exist intersubjectively. Thus, to say that relation as such is intersubjective, to characterize relation in this way, as is commonly done, for example, in contemporary phenomenological analysis, is more than a mistake, it is a distortion. For this characterization does not hold true of relations as such, of relation in the singularity of its being, but applies only to relation in its uniqueness as one among the modes of ens reale. Intersubjectivity concerns relation only as occurring in the order of finite mind-independent being, whereas objectively, relation is supersubjective regardless of whether or not it is intersubjective at any given time. Intersubjectivity concerns directly the circumstances of relation and only indirectly the positive being of relation as indifferent to the circumstances which make it one time to be intersubjective as well as objective and another time to be purely objective and without a positive intersubjective realization. So, let us return to Euclid's triangle, the one we found to be unlocatable in space and time. Unlike any given person's thought or idea of that triangle, which has a very definite location in space and time, right here in Merdine's head. Does Euclid's triangle exist whether it is thought about or not? Plato thought so. Aristotle thought not. Aristotle thought the triangle of Euclidean geometry is brought into being by the intellectual process that he called abstraction, wherein the human being abstracts from the world of experience things a pure object that has no existence as such independently of being thought, fine as far as it goes, but an object pure in this sense. How is it public in principle and the same for all? Triangular shapes are found in the material world, no doubt, but they lack the perfection of Euclid's triangle, nor can they be said to be of two dimensions only. Well, here we encounter a potentially clarifying way the difference in principle between the difference in principle between an object and a thing. A thing exists whether or not anyone thinks of it. It is just what it is, and it remains what it is should someone happen to notice it, regardless of any interpretation, sane or zany, that the noticer may make of the thing. But an object which no one is aware of cannot properly be said to be an object, even though it may be a thing. With Euclid's triangle, however, we have an object that is never a thing. The common usage in modern English, according to which object is just another way of saying thing, is, quite simply, mistaken. Indeed, delusionally so. For while an object, pace Kant, may be, and often enough is, also a thing, what makes a thing be a thing is existing in itself or in another. In other words, belonging to the order of mind-independent being. While an object, be it a thing or not, cannot exist as object except in relation to some knower, some state of awareness. In relation to, that's the key phrase. Let us put it this way. A thing is what it is regardless of whether anyone happens to be aware of it or not. But an object is an object only when and to the extent that someone is aware of it. In other words, relation to a knower, incidental to being a thing, is essential to being an object. Now, relation is a fairly simple mode of being, inasmuch as it involves three factors. One, a foundation, basis, or fundament. Two, the relation itself, the being toward or respecting, which makes the fundament be a fundament. And three, the terminus, or that toward which the relation exists. So when we say that being an object necessarily involves a relation to a knower, we are saying that being an object essentially consists in one or another of these three factors: fundament, relation, terminus. And once the matter is stated in these terms, it seems clear that it is the third factor, the terminus, that will be the object within any relation of direct cognition, while either the relation itself or the fundament as fundament can be made into objects in their own right, but only by means of a critically controlled reflexive awareness on the part of the knower. To appreciate this point, that the difference in principle between an object and thing is that an object necessarily, while a thing only contingently, terminates some awareness of a finite mind, one needs to realize that the being of a fundament as such, regardless of whether it is also a subjective characteristic of something, and likewise the being of a terminus as such, regardless whether it too has a subjective dimension in its existence, derives from the positive being proper to relation as supra-subjective. Take the simplest example of two triangles, A and B, both existing in a given area. So I would draw them on the board, but I'm lazy. There's A and there's B. Got them? Okay. The shape, they are and can be seen to be similar on the basis of their shape. The shape is a subjective characteristic existing in each of the triangles, but is also fundament and terminus in the relation of similarity. Destroy either A or B, and the other is no longer similar thereto, for there is nothing, no longer something to be similar to. And yet the subjective characteristic of shape as a subjective characteristic is in no way changed by the fact of it ceasing to be either a fundament or a terminus. The status of fundament and terminus as terminus, thus, results from the relation, not from the subjectivity of the characteristic viewed as founding or terminating a relation, But what this means is that even when the fundament of a given relation happens to be an idea subjectively present in and modificative of some knower, the terminus of that relation will be respecting that fundamental subjectivity over and above it, see? Precisely terminating the relation as relation, that is to say, as supersubjective, respecting the order of any and all subjective being. Where ideas overlap in their contents subjectively, things will overlap objectively insofar as they are known. Hence, just as any two things can be related to a common third, so any two knowers can share in awareness of a common object. Their respective ideas are not common, see, but are subjective and private to each. But these same ideas, as founding a relation to an object, give to that object an existence supersubjective, respecting the subjective dimension of the idea as private, as my idea or your idea. And hence, the object is public in principle in the way that the ideas themselves not only are not, but cannot be. As terminating relations, objects participate in the supersubjectivity of the relations they terminate, and it is for this reason that objects are public in principle and able to be shared in cognitively and cathectically communicative interactions. Well, maybe, perhaps, we're making some progress in understanding Euclid's triangle, for we now can see that an object is always public in principle, even when it does not or cannot have a subjective existence in the world of things existing as material substances with their distinguishing characteristics. But how does all this, all that we have uncovered about relations so far, how does this help us to understand where these pure objects, such as Euclid's triangle, among many others, where are they in relation to those who are aware of them? It seems to me that the key to resolving this question is to dissolve it on the basis of another feature of relation that has no counterpart in the other modes of mind-independent material being. When we say that a being is material or a material substance, what we are saying in ordinary terms is that it is something that can be seen and touched, something that can be exemplified or instantiated before our eyes. And yet, relations, even those obtaining mind independently and in the material physical order of our universe, relations precisely cannot be seen and touched. They are immaterial in this sense that they involve directly no secondary matter. Now, I say secondary matter in contrast to the Aristotelian idea of primary matter, which is the potentiality within every material individual to cease existing and to have its body assimilated to entirely other things, such as the lion who kills and eats its hunter. The hunter's individual being ceases with death, and the visible, tangible parts of what used to be his or her body become assimilated to the being of the lion, of carrion birds, of worms, of the earth, and whatnot. To say that the hunter is no more is to say that the form of his body, which made it his, no longer controls the matter of that body, but has been displaced and replaced by other forms in the ongoing interaction of physical beings that constitutes the physical universe. Yet these displacing substances, now controlling in various ways the formerly bodily parts of the hunter, are themselves subject to being displaced, and so on ad infinitum, as long as there is a physical universe of interacting finite substances. You best understand the physical universe as the original recycling machine. Thus, Aristotle distinguished the matter as sensible and touchable from the matter as underlying and subject to generations and corruptions. The latter, the underlying matter, we can come to know only by means of critical analysis. We can't isolate it. We can't remove it from the body like it could a cancer tumor. But without it, we cannot explain continuity in the physical universe across generations of new individuals. The former, by contrast, hey, Merdine, she's falling asleep. Merdine. Okay. The former, by contrast, is matter as directly experienced, matter that can be seen and touched. Bodily substances and characteristics are precisely of that former sort, but relation is not. How do you sleep during a gripping talk like this? Oh. Relation, then, in its formal and distinctive being as supersubjective, involves neither primary matter nor secondary matter. By reason of the first, it is in the finite order a dependent sort or mode of being, For relation to exist supersubjectively, there must exist subjectively an individual upon some characteristic of which the relation is founded. Supersubjective in its own being, relation nonetheless depends upon a subjective foundation or ground. By reason of the second fact, relation does not belong to the order of what can be seen or touched, and once arisen, relation is unaffected by distance, a feature which is manifested most dramatically, I would guess, in the phenomena that current physics gathers under the label of quantum weirdness. Individuals need physical proximity to interact, but relations are not interactions. Rather, they are the children of interactions, and as such continue to exist once the interaction has ceased. For near or far, a son is in the same way the son of his father. It's a quote from a Latin. And there is a third feature of relation to be noted, quite related to the second and key for mathematics, but key more generally for semiosis of any sort. Relation is not like a clothesline between two poles. Relation is rather a field concept. One relation can have indefinite number of terms. Thomas Aquinas used the example of parenthood. No matter how many children the couple generates, they each and all constitute the terminus of one same relation of parenthood. When we consider psychological states in the light of this third feature, we find an unexpected and unexpectedly simple resolution to the centuries-old dispute over nominalism. For what distinguishes a psychological state, cognitive or cathectic, is that it cannot exist save by being of or about something other than itself. The person says, hey, I got an idea. I say, well, what's it about? He says, well, what do you mean, what's it about? It's just an idea. It's not about anything. What do? Send the guy over to York or something. For what distinguishes a psychological state is that it cannot exist save by being of or about something other than itself. This is but to say that every psychological state exists by virtue of founding or provenating a relation, the terminus of which, in contrast to the psychological state as a feature of the subjectivity of the knower, the terminus provides that knower with the object of its cognition and affection. Let us try to resolve the problem over which Descartes stumbled, the problem which sent modern philosophy down the way of ideas incompatible with the way of signs. And again, Euclid's triangle provides us with a perfect example. In semiotics, it is necessary to distinguish objects as termini of relations from things insofar as involvement with relations to a finite mind is not essential to being a thing, as we noted. In sensation, it is aspects of things that we become aware of, that we objectify. These aspects, the animal must then interpret in order to survive, structuring the realm of sensations as a world, an Umwelt, objective world. I need some water. Would somebody? Yeah. An objective world, a world of objects. Ah, great. Well, it's not water, but. Objects to be sought, avoided, or safely ignored. That's a judgment the animal makes, and it can get it wrong. And the animal world is filled with things trying to appear as safe to ignore, which are, of course, deadly, and so on. And it's only at that level that mental representations or concepts enter into the animal awareness, not at sensation. In sensation, things, insofar as they are partially apprehended, become objects. Now, what does that mean? They represent themselves insofar as they have entered awareness. Thus, an object is first of all a self-representation. But these self-representations of sensation, as interpreted, become now further objects of other representations. That is to say, objects of perception and intellection as well as of sensation. Thank you very much. Moreover, once the interpreted objects are attained by perception and intellection, they can be thought of even when they are no longer physically present. You can't sense something unless it's physically present, but you can think of it. Moreover, again, when the concept presenting an object as this or that, i.e. as an object of interpretation, when it misrepresents that object in the sense that the concept itself is a misinterpretation or even an act of wishful thinking, There remains the distinction and formal difference between an object as a self-representation and a concept as an other representation. It is this distinction between self-reference and other reference that is collapsed when the very psychological states that we call ideas, images, or concepts are mistaken for the objects represented. That every psychological state of necessity is of or about something is just another way of saying that every psychological state in its proper nature is an other representation rather than a self-representation. Collapsing other representations into self-representation, conflating the two, that's the opening to the way of ideas. That's the beginning of the modern phase of philosophy. Thus, the idea of triangle is something formed in and by each of us whenever we think of a triangle. As such, this idea is part of our subjectivity, part of what separates us from the world around us. But a part which perforce, which gives rise to our relation over and above our subjectivity as separating us from our surroundings, which as a relation gives rise also, that is, supersubjectively, to an object as its terminus. And it is this object, not the idea thereof, that we analyze in demonstrating the necessity of its angles equaling 180 degrees. The objective triangle, then, even though as a pure terminus of a relation, even though, that is, as a purely objective being, it has no material component located here or there in space and time, is the focus of Euclidean geometry, and so it is with all mathematical objects, prior to their application to quantitative aspects of our physical universe, and just as any two things can be related to a common third while yet remaining distinct as things, so two thinkers having the idea of triangle are related to that common third, which is the objective triangle in neither of them. The triangle in its objectivity, not the respective ideas in their subjectivity, established between the two thinkers a common ground, which is in itself neither spatial nor temporal, for it has in itself no secondary matter. Distance, making no difference to relations in their positive being of toward another, is the key to how an object which has no mind-independent existence can yet be common between two or more thinkers. For the difference in principle between objects as self-representations and things as existing independently of a relation to a finite mind, which yet allows, requires, a coincidence in fact of the two within sensation, precisively considered, becomes a difference in fact, as well as in principle, when concepts as other representations are introduced into perception and intellection to interpret the things sensed as objects of this or that kind. And it is just this difference in principle between objects and things that allows for interpreted objects to be known even when there is no immediate sensory ground for their consideration, as it is also this difference which allows us to construct objects which have no sensory instantiation. For it is we who form concepts, but these concepts are not what we know directly, any more than the concept of a clock, which alone enables us to see a given sensory pattern as a clock, is what we first and directly see when we recognize the sensory pattern as instantiating a clock. The formation of a concept within our mind serves in every case, immediately and directly, to relate us to something other than itself, some object, regardless of whether that object here and now has or could have some manner and measure of sensory instantiation or not. Mathematics, thus, forms a central case in anthroposemiosis, for it is not communicable zoosemiotically, and for a very good reason. Animals, capable only of perception, are restricted to awareness of material objects as related, but they have no way to distinguish between the objects related and the relations themselves. Yet it is the relations themselves that formally constitute signs, and these relations are no less invisible to sense perception than they are to sensation itself directly and precisively considered. Sense provides the first sign vehicles, and perception further elaborates these signs into an objective world of desirable, undesirable, and safely ignored features of the surroundings, weaving a semiotic web that enables the animal to orientate itself and move around in its surroundings as it goes about the business of seeking to achieve and ensure its well-being and flourishment. But human understanding goes a further step. The animal, through its experience in forming its umwelt, adds to its surroundings many relations that would not otherwise be there. And it is just these relations that transform the simple physical surroundings, on their side indifferent to the animal, into objects related to the animal as desirable, undesirable, or ignorable. The further step human animals take is to add to the world of objects the mind-dependent relation of self-identity, transforming objects into things, independent of their relation to me as plus, minus, zero, independent of whether they are mind-dependent or mind-independent. A being is what it is, regardless of me as a specific instance of animal, over and above my interest in it, but only the human animal can see it that way. That recognition is what opens the way to investigations we call philosophy or sinoscopic science, just as it also opens the way to further investigations we call science in the idioscopic sense. But notice that the relation of self-identity is a pure construct of understanding. A thing is not identical with itself, it just is itself. Yet to see an object for what it is in itself apart from its relation to my animal self requires me to see it as more than an object. This opening within objectivity, within animal objectivity, to thinghood as something investigatable in its own right beyond objectivity distinguishes human understanding and results from the ability of understanding to grasp relations, even though they are in their formal being invisible to sense. Other animals cannot, even preconsciously, introduce into their umwelt the relation of self-identity, making that objective world a world of things as well as of objects, because they cannot organize their objects on the basis of anything other than the directly sensible properties which base their interpretations plus minus zero. That is why umwelt is a generically animal notion, but the umwelt as species specifically human is also termed a Lebenswelt, an objective world open further to the recognition and investigation of things as things, and the recognition and evaluation of purely objective elements transforming animal social interaction into cultural interaction as well in the human case. Thus, by reason of its capacity to understand the difference between a relation and a related object or thing, the human animal not only depends, like all animals, on the use of signs, but further comes to recognize that there are signs, that is to say, invisible, triadic relations upon which the whole world of objects, both insofar as it does and insofar as it does not involve things, depends. It is in this sense, at least, we should note here, that mathematics presupposes semiosis. For the objects of mathematics, pure or applied, are precisely objects. And every object, as such, presupposes the action of signs in order to exist as something apprehended. Significate, as I have explained at book length, that's literally true, book called Purely Objective Reality, which I urge you to run out and buy. They have it at every newsstand. Significate, resisted by English dictionary makers since the distortion of the subject-object distinction introduced by philosophy's deviation from the way of signs onto the dead-end byway of epistemology, or the way of ideas, is not only a synonym, significates not only a synonym for the term object, but has the further advantage of placing in the foreground of our consciousness what the term object conceals and obfuscates, namely, that apart from semiosis, that is, apart from the action of signs, there actually are no objects, no objects at all. While within semiosis, even virtual objects attain to a kind of actuality. Thus, for animals, objects are inextricably mixed with things. But human animals can transcend this extrication to deal not only with material objects, whether correctly or incorrectly interpreted, but also with pure objects, recognized as such, objects which have never yet or even never could be things within the physical surroundings. Euclid's triangle is just such an object, but so is the whole realm of relations that we call pure mathematics. Other animals indeed recognize and deal with objects in their plurality, but they cannot number them, because one, as a number, is not this or that material object. But any object at all, regarded in a particular way, under the unity of a specifying relation. Nor can other animals abstract from the material object its quantitative dimension upon which geometry is based. Thus, arithmetic and geometry have their roots in the world of material objects as multiple and quantified, but their flower comes about only through the ability of human understanding to deal with relations in their difference from and irreducibility to related objects and things. Is it coincidence that Pythagoras, about 582 to 495 BC, is it a coincidence that Pythagoras, the first thinker to recognize the importance of mathematics for the understanding of nature, that he was also, according to the ancient Greeks, now some of the Oxford scholars challenged this, but of course, you know, you can only make your reputation as a scholar by challenging. But according to the ancient Greeks, who are in the best position to know, after all, even if they lacked Oxford training, it was Pythagoras who was the coiner of the term philosophy. Is that a coincidence? I think hardly. Now, I have written this paper with three books there on my left hand on the desktop. The 1984 translation by Toomer of Mathematicae Syntaxis from 150 AD, better known as Ptolemy's Almagest. The 1978 Rosen translation of Copernicus De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium of 1543. And the 1687 AD Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica of Isaac Newton in the 1999 translation of Cohen and Whitman. I lack perhaps only key works of Einstein and Planck. These were my inspiration, but not my focus. My focus has been narrower, to wit, the singularity of relation, which alone among the varieties of mind-independent being is able to exist also purely objectively. The singularity which lies at the basis as constituting the prior possibility of semiosis, the action of signs, without which there would be no mathematics, and probably no transformation of the universe in the direction of intelligent life, as the anthropic principle of modern physics gropingly suggests or indicates. When Professor Kuhl asked us earlier in this week, what mathematical structure is semiosis then? Just as when he unquestionably embraces the assumption that semiosis is criterial of life, I suggest he may be having us look in the wrong direction. For our universe, though perfused with signs and unknowable without signs, yet does not consist exclusively of signs. Semiosis is essential to the whole story, but it is far from being itself the whole story. Indeed, objects, even though they presuppose signs, and normally themselves become signs, commonly participate in the physical reality of the universe. Yet, just as things are in principle distinct from objects, so objects do not simply reduce to things. Umwelt includes something of, but itself transcends, physical surroundings. And even the pure objects do not reduce to semiosis. Thus, it is not semiosis that presupposes mathematics or life, but the reverse. It is the singularity of relation as a mode of being, knowable only reflexively and not by direct sensation or perception. That is where we must look if we are to discern the heart of semiosis. The basis, as Heidegger might have put it, of the prior possibility of the action of signs. And while the action of signs is everywhere at work, that action is not by any means everything. Still, nothing better illustrates that action from within anthroposemiosis than the development of mathematics, applied, yes, but especially pure mathematics. I leave it to our colleague, Marcel Denesi, to explain in Fibonacci numbers this conclusion of a recovering slide rule addict. That's the end, but let me make a brief comment on the reference to Heidegger. Heidegger, I think it was in 1943, wrote an essay called On the Essence of Truth. And he starts out the essay, Heidegger, unlike the typical contemporary philosopher, really knew medieval philosophy. So he starts out his discussion on the essence of truth by citing the common medieval definition, truth is the correspondence of thought with thing. But he then goes on to say, what is the prior, what is the the basis of the prior possibility of such a correspondence. How can there be a correspondence of thought with thing? And this he calls the question of the essence of truth. So some years later, I was reading the first systematic treatise on signs that we know of from 1632, and he was talking about the singularity of relation. He made a point like this. If I have the bone of a dinosaur, and I have sufficient scientific knowledge to recognize it as the bone of a dinosaur, and I'm able to classify it correctly as the bone of, say, a brontosaurus, see, I have now created mind-dependently the very same relation that under other circumstances would be mind-independent, see. The bone of the dinosaur is not related to the dinosaur intersubjectively now because there is no dinosaur, see. But it was so related under other circumstances of the past. When in the present the scientist is able to recreate that relation, the circumstances under which he creates it makes it be a mind-dependent relation, but it's the very same relation that under other circumstances was mind-independent. And there's the answer. There's the answer to Heidegger's question. And then one quick example to help grasp this object-thing distinction. You go into the doctor for your checkup, you know, and he checks you over and he says, look, I got bad news for you. You've got cancer. We're sending you in for more complete results. Come back Wednesday. So you leave the doctor's office probably in a bad mood or, you know, depressed. You go back Wednesday and the doctor says, hey, I got good news for you. We got the samples mixed up. You don't have cancer at all. What were you depressed about? Get it? The cancer was an object. It wasn't in the doctor's mind, it wasn't in your mind, and it wasn't in your body. It wasn't a thing. It was a pure object. And yet it controlled your whole mood and emotions. Second case. This happened to a friend of mine. Goes to the doctor for a physical checkup. I got great news for you. You're in great health. I'll see you next year. 7 months later, he died of a virulent cancer that the doctor had failed to detect. In the second case, the cancer was a thing, but not an object, see? Then, the happy case, the good news. You have cancer, you go to the doctor, he detects it and tells you, and they go to work on it. The cancer now is both a thing and an object, see? That's the good news. You have no sense of humor. That's it. Subjectivity is everything that separates us where we stop and the rest of the universe begins. So subjectivity is everything that isolates us within the universe. Supersubjectivity is, or just relation, is what connects us to other things. And then you get into all these problems about are the relations real or not. If you accuse, you know, a person is accused of a crime in the United States, say, is convicted of the crime and is killed, goes to the death penalty for it, and he didn't commit the crime. This, of course, couldn't happen in the United States, but you could imagine it. What was he killed by? See? What distinguishes the action of signs, in physics, you know, if you want to run your car into a tree, I don't know why you'd want to do that, but if you do want to do that, you got to have a car and you got to have a tree and you run it into it. But in the action of signs, you know, I told my class in Bulgaria, the way I got the money to go to Bulgaria was I robbed a bank. And when the police were after me, and I went over this hill where they couldn't see me, and I jumped out of the car, and there was a fork in the road, and I put a sign up on the left fork that said, bridge out. And then I went up the left fork. The police came over the hill, said, which way did he go? I said, well, bridge is out. He must have gone this way. And here I am, a wealthy man with the bank's money. Semiosis is an inaction that involves non-being. And it's actually a way in which the future, through the present, changes the relevance of the past. See? That's what's different about semiosis. And it's all rooted in the singularity of relation. That's why in Sidiok, in Sidiok's time, in the in the 60s in the United States and in Europe and even in the Soviet sphere, the whole notion of sine was conceived arbitrarily on Saussure's dyadic model. See? And Sivyak said, that's a pars pro toto fallacy. There are only two ways to conceive semiology. Either it's just a last gasp of modern idealism in philosophy, or it's simply a part of a much larger whole, which is semiotics. And the notion of what is the sign is not something you stipulate, it's something you investigate. And when you investigate it, you find out what Peirce found out and what Poinsot found out long before him, that in order for there to be a sign, you have to have something standing in the foreground position of representing something other than itself, two or four, some third. See? And so you have two different kinds of signs. Some signs have to be an object in order to be a sign, and other signs have to be signs in order to become objects, psychological states you come to know only by reflection. And they had a way of, all of this comes out of the Latin Age, out of the closing centuries of the Latin Age. You had the first development of semiotic consciousness between the lifetime of Thomas Aquinas, 13th century, and the lifetime of Poinsot, Galileo, and Descartes. But that whole last period, those centuries, are completely omitted from the study of medieval philosophy. See, it's just a whole. And if you look at the analytic philosophers, history of philosophy, they'll tell you, oh, there's nothing that happened there. That's precisely when semiotics developed. And the first discovery, not stipulation, the first discovery that the sign necessarily consists in a triadic relation, and not all relations are triadic, but sign relations are triadic, was John Poinsot. And he demonstrated it in 1632. That's not what's original with Peirce. What's original with Peirce is the distinction between an interpreter and an interpretant, which opens the action of signs beyond the world of animals. Now, Tom Sivyak, who was the main revolutionary figure in the 20th century, he saw that, but he opined, he came to the conclusion. I was in the audience at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, and he gave an address entitled, Are Sign Science and Life Science Coextensive? And his answer was, yes, they are. That is, life depends on signs, but you only have semiosis in the realm of life. It's not that semiosis equals life, as was wrongly stated in the lecture here, but that they're coextensive. And I remember sitting in the audience and saying to myself, Tom, you're wrong about that. And then he invited me the following year to contribute to some biosemiotics yearbook, and I wrote a paper titled, Are the Sign Science and the Life Science Coextensive? No. And we went around on that. So it's funny that Tom, the revolutionary figure, became the conservative figure in semiotics. But I called it, in the 1990 book, physiosemiosis, that is, an action of signs, triadic relations, which virtually involve, but not actually, objects, where the future is constantly rearranging the relevance of the past through the present. Physiosemiosis, a semiosis that is prior to and independent of life. But it's very, very slow moving, and it's like somebody trying to light a cigarette, you know, and they light the match and the match flares up and then it goes out. Then they try again and the match flares up and goes out. In the universe, you have an initial state where there's no life and no possibility of life, and they're just interacting. And then I really like, I got to get these names straight. Is it Mark? Yeah, just let me.
Whether relation and also physiosemiosis can exist without supersubjectivity.
No.
Okay.
But I really like Marx's formula. How do you get something more from nothing but? And he's not talking about an earthquake or something. That's still in the nothing but category. But the universe starts out with no life and no possibility of life, and then by stages, it moves where life becomes more and more possible and then actual. And I think that is already the process of semiosis, because semiosis is the only kind of causality that involves not only being but non-being.
But then you can also say that subjectivity can exist without life.
But exists without life as intersubjectivity. Is that Deacon's face? Thanks. Deacon has a pretty fine book called The Symbolic Animal.
Symbolic Species.
But from a more strictly semiotic point of view, symbols do not distinguish the human species. Sebeck gave all kinds of examples of symbols in non-human species. But there is a book titled Semiotic Animal, and then it has a subtitle, A Postmodern Definition of Human Being Transcending Patriarchy and Feminism, wherein all these discussions, including Deacon's, are included. So I recommend that as you rush to the newsstand to buy purely objective reality, you buy Semiotic Animal as well. If the newsstand doesn't have it, go to Amazon. It's a joke. Thanks for this. It was a lifesaver. Good. Good. I'd like to get that material. You know that preface I wrote for the Chinese? I'd like to get that somehow incorporated into that. Wikipedia entry keeps getting shorter and shorter and stupider and stupider. It says nothing, you know? It used to say some interesting things. Can you help with that at all? Do you ever fool around with
that? Well, I'm not active in that part, but I think students of yours can do it.
Me and Tartu. I don't want to do it directly because I just don't feel right about that. I trust it to you, my agent. Hi.
That's great. Have you ever had an opportunity to discuss this with Searle, for example?
I've met Searle. I've been present at things. He's not. I don't get the impression he's somebody that is much interested in discussion.
In discussion?
Yeah.
No, he preaches.
Yeah. And also.
He's close to the point of view.
Is he? Well, see, I think the whole analytic philosophy establishment is a house of cards waiting to fall. It's so stupid.
He can't stand it.
No. No. The amazing thing about Searle.
His speech act stuff goes there.
I heard some terrific sermons of his.
Yeah.
And he speaks in these absolutely complete grammatical sentences, you know, like he has no difference between speaking and reading for Searle. No, he's really bright, but God, he's insufferably arrogant. I didn't even bother to try to meet him when I was at the conference.
Yeah. Great fun, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
But this is interesting. I think you something about this.
Great. Hi.
I just wanted to thank you for this excellent lecture. It was very insightful.
I want to thank you for being here. I just hate the thought of you going back because of that radioactive problem.
Yeah, I am going back.
I know, you more or less have to. I would probably be going back if I were in your position, but still, let me know. I'm a little worried about it.
Well, I just wanted to really thank you for the lecture. It was really insightful.
I wanted to ask you, we're not going to have really any time to talk about things, but I wanted to ask you, you showed how in programming you can do it either on a dyadic or a triadic because you can find a way. But does one work better than the other, or do they work equally well?
Oh, they what they do finally would be the same. It would be two.
Final outcome would be the same.
Yes, but I think your lecture gave me. I have to rethink what I wrote.
Well, it's the thing object. It's how things can be the same and yet different in principle. That's why I pointed to you that book.
So
purely
actually, your talk was very parallel to mine, but in much higher resolution. And
I thought your talk was great. Yeah.
It was very impressive.
I think you'll find that little book I gave you useful.
Yes. Okay.
Let's see. I want to ask you something. That just went right out of my mind. I think I'm getting too old.
Not yet.
I'm actually.
Music animals that was Thank you.